extraordinary moment. The foreign correspondents largely ignored it, although Virginia Cowles at least noticed that the hotel where she was staying seemed to be being run by its busboys and elevator operators. Lois Orr observed the whole thing, wrote about it in a remarkable series of letters home.
Well, we're going to continue this conversation after the show and post online at democracynow.org, including asking you your thoughts on Donald Trump and his comments about fascism. Spain in Our Hearts is the name of Adam Hochschild's new book. He teaches at the Graduate School of Journalism, University of California, Berkeley, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939. And that does it for our broadcast. We're beginning our 100 City Tour next week. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. Happy Cesar Chavez Day. It is time for the evening news.
What happens when Oz and Wonderland collide in a twisted brain of a mad composer? A freaking musical, of course. KBOO is proud to present Nick T. Devlin's new musical, Alice Trippin' Sixes. It's a strange and unusual music odyssey. Flying monkeys, scarecrows, jokers, and even midday tokers. Oh, this ain't your normal musical, man. It's a far-out psychedelic trip into the mind of the mad. This is going to be one wild and crazy musical event. Alice Trippin' Sixes, Thursday, March 31st at 10 p.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the film screening of Firefighters, Architects, Engineers, Expose 9/11 Myths on Saturday, April 2nd, at the Portland State University Lincoln Performance Center in Portland. The film will be introduced by Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. There will also be a Q&A session after the film. Again, that's a screening of the film, Firefighters, Architects, Engineers, Expose 9/11 Myths with Richard Gage, Saturday, April 2nd, at the Portland State University Lincoln Performance Center, 1620 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News.
The FDA approves the first genetically modified animal, but people are fighting back against Frankenfish.
The Portland Tenants Union is riding herd on the high cost of living. We bring organizer Margot Black into Studio 2 for a live interview.
And one of the biggest corporation scandals in oil industry history just erupted.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 31st, 2016. I'm Lisa Loving.
And I'm Jamie Haddad. Oregon environmental officials today said the newest air quality reports around two glass factories in southeast Portland do not show heightened levels of risk for residents. Five air quality monitors, one set up near the Orobos Glass in North Portland and four near Bullseye Glass Company in southeast Portland, have been running 24 hours a day since March 1st. Officials say air monitors deployed in southeast and North Portland continue to show low levels of heavy metals. Weekly air monitoring data is being reported each Thursday by an interagency group that includes the DEQ, the OHA, and Multnomah County Health Department, and published at saferair.oregon.gov. This data includes results of 24-hour monitoring during the week ending March 15th. Both companies voluntarily suspended use of the metals of concern in February. Experts say there has been no change in levels of metal in the air since monitoring data for the week ending March 8th, and they were reported on March 24th. The levels of all metals measured in the air near Bullseye were many times lower than what was measured there in October 2015, according to today's air monitoring results. The monitoring locations are the same five sites as those used in February to collect air samples that were reported on March 24th.
Legalized camping for houseless people is likely headed to Benton County. The Corvallis Gazette reports today the Housing Opportunities Action Council voted yesterday to approve a proposal legalizing public camping. Their first development is being called First Camp, but it must still be approved by the Corvallis City Council before becoming a reality. The move was proposed by former Corvallis City Councilor Richard Hervey and former Benton County Sheriff Jim Swinyard. It calls for a six-month privately funded pilot program for one fenced-in camping spot that must be established on private property suitable for no more than 30 people.
Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley and Congressman Earl Blumenauer are teaming up with several tribes that fish along the Columbia River to seek out federal funding for fishing sites. Their efforts will specifically focus on tribes whose ancestral fishing grounds were uprooted by the creation of the Dalles, Bonneville, and John Day dams. There are currently 31 such fishing sites in Oregon, but many are in poor condition. They hope to find enough money to clean up current sites and build proper house facilities in the future. Back in November, senators and congressmen from Oregon and Washington teamed up to petition the Army Corps of Engineers to step up and build the houses after years of broken promises. Direct congressional action, including a bill to fund the projects, could lead to more immediate results for the tribes.
An Oregon law restricting gold mining near salmon habitat has been upheld by the U.S. District Court in Medford. The ruling comes after gold miners sued the state last year, arguing that federal laws supersede state law on natural resource regulation in Oregon. But the District of Oregon Court disagreed, saying the state has the right to regulate state and federal land to preserve fish habitat and water quality.
In November of last year, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration legalized genetically engineered Atlantic salmon created in labs at a biotech company called AquaBounty. In response to this move, a wide-stretching coalition of environmental watchdogs, fish and wildlife preservationists, and commercial fishing interests have teamed up to sue the FDA. The coalition plans to attack the FDA's very authority to pass such a measure. The FDA used an obscure 1938 statute as legal basis for approving what many are referring to as the Frankenfish. In this case, the FDA treats genetically engineering as the same thing as giving drugs and vaccinations to livestock. KBOO reporter Kanan Schlesinger spoke with George Kimbrell, a senior attorney representing one of the plaintiffs in the case against the FDA Center for Food Safety.
I have with me here George Kimbrell, senior attorney with the Center for Food Safety. Center for Food Safety is part of a lawsuit against the FDA having to do with their recent approval of genetically engineered fish that will eventually make its way into commercial markets. Can you briefly describe how the FDA was able to approve the first genetically engineered animal?
Sure. It's a fairly unusual idea to have FDA be the agency that's charged with approving and assessing all of the potential risks of genetically engineered animals, but it's the one that we have, that our government has decided is the way they're going to proceed. And one of the arguments in the litigation that we're bringing, in which I'm counsel, in which our organization is one of the plaintiffs, is that that is an improper way to proceed, and that it's not the right agency. It doesn't have the right tools to analyze the environmental risks, for example, of novel genetically engineered animals. But it's a process that began at FDA a number of years ago. They had the first public meetings, and the first proposal of approval was 2010, and they had subsequent draft decisions in 2012 and 13, and the final approval was given last fall around Thanksgiving. So it's fairly recent, and as you mentioned, it's the first of its kind. It's first of its kind in that it's the first ever genetically engineered animal for food, for consumption, that's been approved, and it happens to be a salmon, a genetically engineered salmon, engineered by a company named AquaBounty, that they have inserted into an Atlantic salmon genes from a Pacific salmon, as well as from a deep water ocean eel called an eel pout, that the genes of which help it to grow faster, or that's what Aqua Bounty alleges. So it will grow faster than a conventional salmon. It's engineered to do that.
And does Aqua Bounty seem like an accountable, responsible company, by your understanding?
No, I think it's fair to describe them as kind of Monsanto's even crazier cousin or something along those lines. This is a bad idea by any stretch of the imagination. I think people here in the Pacific Northwest understand better than anyone the reverence that salmon should be held in, their cultural significance. In this region in particular, it's hard to overstate. And the idea that we would genetically engineer one, I think, on many levels, is one that people would reject. Of course, in addition to approving this fish, FDA has also refused the requests of us and many of our allies and over almost 2 million Americans that asked the agency if they did approve it to make sure it was labeled, and they denied that request, so they've given approval and also refused to label the fish.
And can you describe what the Center for Food Safety and the other plaintiffs involved in the case want to accomplish in this litigation?
Well, we're asking the court to set aside or to stop the approval that FDA's given here. We have a number of legal claims that we've brought, but, you know, they kind of break down into twofold. On one subset, we've said this is an unprecedented approval, and along the lines of how I started, our argument is that the Food and Drug Administration should not be approving genetically engineered animals like this engineered salmon under a statute that was passed by Congress in 1938, the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, that never perceived genetically engineered animals nor their novel risks to health and the environment, and that if genetically engineered animals are to be approved, that federal agencies, FDA or any other, need new congressional authority in order to make such a decision. They can't shoehorn that decision under very old statutes that are a very bad fit, that are very much a square peg in a round hole. Mm. They entirely failed to consider risks to ocean ecosystems and to wild salmon stocks when these fish escape confinement, and what that might do to endangered salmon that are already on the precipice of extinction.
Well, thank you, George. I'm speaking with George Kimbrell, senior attorney with the Center for Food Safety. George, thank you so much for lending your perspective.
Thanks for having me.
George Kimbrell and the Center for Food Safety are mounting a legal battle along with a broad swath of other interests against Food and Drug Administration for approving the first ever genetically engineered animal to be commercially sold in the marketplace. I'm Kanan Schlesinger with KBOO News.
Housing and the lack of it is one of the most important issues facing our communities today. Here to talk about what's happening with the tenants' rights community is Margot Black of the Portland Tenants Union. Margot, we are honored to have you with us tonight.
Thank you. I'm honored to be on the show.
First off, Margot, can you tell us a little bit about the Tenants' Rights Union? What do you do?
Well, Portland Tenants United aims to create a city or metro-wide tenants union where tenants can collectively exert their power in order to negotiate better living conditions in our rentals. We want to organize tenants in the way that we organize laborers and bring about greater rights and protections in the same way the labor movement did. In the short term, we are employing a more direct action technique and rapid response technique in order to put pressure on our policymakers in order to even just get us the protections that we need to be able to form those unions, and also to try to keep people in their homes who've been evicted through rent increases or no-cause evictions.
The Portland Association of Teachers yesterday passed a resolution specifically supporting your work. What was in the resolution, and what does it mean to renters in our region?
Well, the resolution just stipulated what is happening in Portland in terms of our dramatic rent increases. And when we wrote the resolution, actually, we hadn't received news yet that our rent rose faster than anywhere else in the nation from February to March, I think 14% in 1 month. And because this was to the Portland Association of Teachers, we highlighted the plight of housing insecurity on children and families. You know, children don't do well in school when they have unsafe and insecure housing. You know, every time they have to move, even in district, I think they lose a month of schooling. It takes that much time to catch back up. So we asked Portland Association of Teachers to support our work to end no-cause evictions and move to a just-cause eviction model in order to keep our most vulnerable residents, and that being children and families, securely housed.
I mean, it's astonishing. You mentioned the fact that rents went up 14% in 1 month. How the heck did the rents get so high so quickly?
Well, let's set aside the supply and demand argument for just a moment and acknowledge the fact that rents only go up when landlords actually raise them. I mean, it's not like a physiological system where if I don't eat, I get hungry. They have to actually make the choice to write a new rent on the rental agreement, and that is why rents are going up, is because people are choosing to charge high rents. Now, why are we paying them? Why is the market bearing them? Well, for a lot of reasons. It costs a lot of money for us to move, and there aren't very many options. There's nowhere to go. And so in one sense, we're captive hostages in our homes. So when our rents go up by $100 to $300, as hard as it is to make that work, and it is, moving right now is even harder when you have a $2,000 security deposit and you can't even stay in the city of Portland. We also have income inequality coming to Portland in full force. We're bringing in a lot of, we're importing a lot of high-paid workers who are able to pay a higher price tag, and they see our higher price tags as being a relief from the high-priced housing markets they left in Seattle or the Bay Area. And all of this is, of course, exacerbated by the fact that we don't have enough supply, but the lack of supply is only exacerbating our lack of protections in a market like this. If we had stronger protections, people would be able to at least stay in their homes and not have to choose between medicine or food and rent.
What's your strategy for pushing back on the market forces?
Well, it's multi-pronged. In the short term, we are raising awareness and consciousness around the issue. We are talking to, you know, the people in the streets and our neighborhoods, and first of all, just helping them realize that this isn't really, it's not normal, it's not okay, you're not a loser for being a renter. You know, the solution isn't just buy a house or just wait for them to build more. That it's actually a totally reasonable thing to demand stronger tenants' protections, which is kind of a shock to most people. They said, you know, if you don't want to be displaced, just buy a house. And one has to really ask the question, like, why is paying rent to a bank more valuable than paying rent to a landlord? So first, we're just, you know, really working on talking to people and getting them to see that our system is very sick and broken and that it is absolutely okay to demand better. We're also talking to our policymakers. We're trying to bring these issues to the mayoral and city council races. We are putting pressure on landlords and their lobbyists to be better actors and to recognize the essential, you know, violence of their exploitative practices. And we do that by, you know, finding somebody who is about to be displaced. We just got done working with a 78-year-old and her 55-year-old disabled husband who had been given a no-cause eviction. You'll see a story about that soon on our website. But, you know, we go in and say, look, do you want the city to see what it looks like when you make a 78-year-old woman and her disabled husband homeless because she has no access to recourse and legal representation and the laws are so stacked against the tenants in the state? And they say, no, we don't want you to tell anybody. We'll negotiate. And so, you know, we were able to get the eviction dismissed and allow them to stay in their home. But we're putting pressure on landlords and helping them see that what they're doing isn't right and that if this, you know, as soon as we shine the spotlight on it, the gig will be over. And as we build our power and our numbers, then people will, the spotlight will be shown and the gig will be over. So we're doing it any way we can. We want tenant protections, housing security, housing dignity by any means possible.
We've seen action in the past few months by Mayor Charlie Hales and also the city of Gresham to address the housing emergency, but do you think their efforts are adequate?
I think the city of Portland is doing some pretty creative stuff on the houseless community. They've lifted the camping bans. They've allowed the organized camps like Hazelnut Grove and Forgotten Realms to set up. They've opened shelter space and they've brought in storage facilities. And I think all of that is really great. I think that there is a complete lack of recognition for the challenges that a market rate renter faces. And by a market rate, I just mean that they're not in subsidized affordable housing. So there are plenty of people who are low income living in market rate rentals who don't have any protections against rent increases and no cause evictions. And the only thing the city did was extend notice periods on rent increases and no cause evictions to 90 days, which is better than a poke in the eye, but even that has unintended consequences. Sometimes you find housing early on in that 90 days, and then you're faced with a lease break fee or double rent for a month as you're transitioning into that new housing. But it's just not enough. It's, we're still seeing rents, it didn't prevent a $200 or $300 rent increase, $400 or $500 rent increase. It doesn't prevent the abuse.
And I think the phone lines just cut out, so we will try to get back to Margot if there's time. If you would like more information about the Portland Tenants United, please visit them on Facebook or by emailing margo@pdxtu.org.
All right. And moving on, some local residents who receive food stamps could be in for an unpleasant shock tomorrow. New changes in the work requirements for SNAP qualification are increasing for people in Multnomah and Washington counties between 18 and 49 deemed able-bodied who have no dependents. That's people who are between age 18 and 49 and deemed, quote, able-bodied who have no dependents. Claimants in that category whose working hours fall below the new 20 hours per week threshold will no longer qualify. Hours can include qualifying nonprofit volunteer work and official job training programs. Oregon's Department of Human Services has been engaging with clients affected in a bid to minimize the impact, but admit that some will fall through the cracks. The new rules have been slammed by concerned groups who insist it will impact the most vulnerable citizens, particularly those affected by homelessness. Impacted listeners can speak to a DHS caseworker in their area. Multnomah County residents should call 971-673-2422. Those in Washington County should call 503-693-4769. In other news, U.S.-based oil and gas companies yesterday were linked to emails detailing systemic bribery to secure international mining and sales contracts. Now, a petition calling for an end to fossil fuel leasing on public lands and waters has garnered more than 100,000 signatures on the White House's We the People online platform, surpassing the threshold necessary to trigger an official response from the White House. David Turnbull with Oil Change International spoke about developments on both the domestic front and the international dynamics with KBOO reporter Robin Ryan.
Your organization, as part of a coordinated effort, has gathered and now delivered more than 100,000 signatures to petition the President of the United States to halt the sale of public waters and lands to the fossil fuel industry. Any idea when a response to this set of demands might be expected?
Well, we know that this is not a new issue for them. This shouldn't come out of thin air. So we're hopeful for a response in a few weeks. When we looked on the We the People petition platform that the White House hosts, it looks like those petitions are often responded to in weeks or months. So it's not entirely clear, but we're hoping to hear from them in the next few weeks, hopefully. We were excited to see that the Obama administration put a halt or a moratorium on leasing of coal from public land in recent months. So our hope is that they will do the same for oil and gas as well, because we know that this leasing program really flies in the face of our efforts to address climate change.
A demonstration staged at last week's auction in New Orleans to lease drilling rights to the Gulf of Mexico is said to have had no impact, but others contend the bidding did not generate the kind of figures seen at comparable events in the past. Have you any feel for the gap between what the governmental entities secure in terms of revenue as compared to what the companies leasing those rights make from the transaction?
You know, a lot of these sales are really undervalued, given the cost to society and the cost to the government and to all of us for the oil that's being extracted and the climate change that is being caused. Those lease sales are really a bargain for the industry. We're seeing that some of these lease sales aren't getting the interest that they have in years past. And while some of that may have to do with the low oil price that occurring around the world, we know that we're having an impact as well. When an industry or a company is making its calculations about the business environment in any given situation, our activism, the public's real objection to a lot of these lease sales has to play a factor. It has to play a role. And so we're confident that the objections and the activism and the real outpouring of concern about this program is having an impact. How much or how exactly that can be quantified, that's a hard question to answer. But we know that the government is selling off these leases for a bargain, and the industry, even at that rate, is starting to have some pause.
Between the recent disclosures over Exxon's awareness of their industry's impact on the planet and yesterday's revelation about the pervasive level of bribery to obtain oil and gas contracts in the Middle East, on the African continent, what standards can be expected of the companies who, through these leases, have the fate of entire ecosystems in their hands?
Every day, it seems, there's a new scandal involving the oil industry, whether it was Exxon's lying about climate change or Unaoil's bribery around the world. This is an industry that's a dirty industry. It's dirty because it's impacting our climate on a day-to-day basis. It's dirty because it's impacting our communities with oil spills and fracking and all these other ways that the industry is just a simply dirty industry. So whether it's corruption abroad or essentially trying to influence our politicians in Washington, D.C., as well as around the country through campaign contributions, the industry does whatever it can to continue making the massive profits that it makes. So we need to stand up and fight back and say this isn't acceptable. It's not acceptable to be bribing government officials around the world. It's not acceptable to be trying to throw money around Washington, D.C. to ensure that their interests are being dealt with and protected. And it's not okay for the oil industry to continue digging up dirty oil that's making our climate on the brink of catastrophe.
I've been talking with David Turnbull from Oil Change International. For more information, you can visit their website at priceofoil.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
We are back on the phone with Margot Black of the Portland Tenants United Group. Hello, Margot. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Wonderful.
Sorry, we got cut off.
No worries. Thank you so much for sticking around for another couple of minutes. I've got a couple more questions for you.
Sure.
What's up next for the Portland Tenants United Group?
Well, we have a rally coming up on April 7th. That's next Thursday at 9 a.m. in front of the county building. And at that rally, we will ask Multnomah County to use its statutory power to enact rent control, which is legal in a time of natural or man-made disaster that results in a significant material elimination of housing. And we know we are in a disaster, and we believe that housing has been materially eliminated through no-cause evictions, through rent increases that displace families, through Airbnb taking thousands of units off the market, through speculative real estate, through demolitions of formerly affordable housing converted into unaffordable housing. So there's no doubt that we have huge numbers of displaced people who had housing and didn't have it before. And so we're going to ask the county to enact rent control. Now, what that looks like, we're not sure yet, maybe a freeze on rents and a moratorium on evictions. We also have to make sure that we can lower our screening barriers so that folks can get into housing that is available. So that's the next big thing. We have a meeting coming up, a general membership meeting on April 17th, where people can find out how to plug in and get involved in what we're doing. And in between, you know, reach out to us, info@pdxtu.org. Follow us on Facebook. You know, we need all hands on deck. We need people to educate themselves about rent control and tenant protections. We need you to talk to your friends and your neighbors and your coworkers and your bosses. We need to tell your bosses to support this effort, because it's easier for landlords to charge less rent than it is for your bosses to, you know, just keep raising your wages if your landlord's just going to keep vacuuming that out of your pocket. So we need to just get the message out of there.
Thank you so much, Margot, for being with us today. That was Margot Black of the Portland Tenants United. Connect with them on Facebook or by emailing margot@pdxtu.org or go to www.pdxtu.org. The FCC today voted 3-2 to expand Lifeline, a program created under President Reagan to provide discounts on phone services to low-income households. The program update would allow Americans who receive federal assistance through SNAP or Medicaid to also receive a $9.25 subsidy per month to go toward getting internet service. The new subsidy could be used for either wireless or wired internet services. Over 13 million people who currently qualify for the Lifeline subsidy don't have internet services. $2.25 billion have been allocated for the program, which is expected to go into effect as early as December.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. Tomorrow's weather is gorgeous sunny sunshine with highs near 75 degrees. Today in history, in 1927, National Farm Workers Association co-founder and president Cesar Chavez was born in Yuma, Arizona. The quote of the day is from Cesar Chavez. He said, "We cannot seek achievement for ourselves and forget about progress and prosperity for our community. Our ambitions must be broad enough to include the aspirations and needs of others for their sakes and for our own." Chavez also originated the phrase, "Sí, se puede."
It is now 5:31, time for your daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The basic problem facing the corporate and political powers who want you and me to swallow their Trans-Pacific Partnership deal is that they can't make chicken salad out of chicken manure. But that reality has not stopped their PR campaign, which pitches their salad as good and good for you. For example, a corporate front called the Peterson Institute for International Economics recently issued a study blaring the happy news that TPP will increase real incomes in the U.S. by $131 billion a year. Even if that was true, and plenty of other studies show that it's not, it's a statistic meant to dazzle rather than enlighten. For it skates around the real bottom line for the American public: an increase in income for whom? In the past 15 years or so, and especially since 2008, it's been made perfectly clear to the workaday majority of people that the corporate mantra of income growth benefiting everyone is a deliberate lie. Practically all of the massive annual increases in U.S. income, which every worker helps produce, now gushes up to the richest 1%, with millionaires and billionaires, the one-tenth of one percenters, grabbing the bulk of it. Economists have a technical term for this: stealing. TPP is written specifically to sanction and increase the robbery of the many by the world's moneyed few, including provisions that give additional incentives to U.S. manufacturers to ship more of our middle-class jobs to places like Vietnam, with minimum wages under 65 cents an hour. This is Jim Hightower saying, don't be bamboozled by glittery studies. TPP is a manure salad tossed together by the super-rich to further enrich themselves at our expense. And it would intentionally exacerbate the widening gulf of inequality in America. For information and action, go to citizen.org/trade.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Last week, an Israeli soldier shot and killed an already wounded 21-year-old Palestinian man who had attempted a stabbing attack. B'Tselem, a human rights group based in Israel, filmed the entire incident, which also shows an Israeli soldier carted off in an ambulance. Another Palestinian was also killed during the incident. The soldier, whose name has not been released, will now face charges of manslaughter instead of murder, using an argument of self-defense. The UN special rapporteur weighed in on the situation, expressing that the killing is a, quote, clear case of an extrajudicial execution. This is not the first time in recent weeks Israel has come under scrutiny for the killings. 11 members of the U.S. Congress recently wrote to Secretary of State John Kerry to look into cases of extrajudicial killings by the Israel Defense Forces.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon yesterday called on countries to resettle nearly 500,000 Syrian refugees. So far, places have only been found for about 185,000. His remarks came at a one-day summit hosted by the UN's Refugee Agency, attended by representatives from more than 90 countries. The vast majority of Syrian refugees needing placement are currently in countries immediately surrounding Syrian borders. But opponents of resettlement have latched onto the attacks by Muslim extremists in Brussels and Paris to argue against allowing Syrians into some European countries. Further complicating the issue are tensions within communities of refugees and among other recent immigrants. Tom Karstensen has more.
Patrons in this shisha cafe in the Belgian city of Mechelen smoke Arab water pipes like they do back home. The owner of the cafe is an Armenian Syrian from the minority Christian population in the war-torn country. He doesn't want his name or the cafe's name made public as he's afraid of sectarian retaliation. He migrated to Belgium 10 years ago. His friend Narek has only been here about a year. Narek is not his real name. He uses a pseudonym because he's afraid of Islamists finding him in Belgium, and there are plenty here. Narek sought to leave behind the violence perpetrated by members of various warring factions. Now he's worried about Europe's future due to sectarianism imported from the Middle East with the massive influx of asylum seekers and migrants. Until recently, he's been living in refugee centers and is unnerved by talk he's overheard between Islamists there.
Too many, they were not hiding that they are very much supporter of Jabhat al-Nusra.
Jabhat al-Nusra is al-Qaeda's armed wing in the Syrian civil war and is one of the groups that is not party to the current tenuous ceasefire.
How do they know if this person was from ISIS or that one is from Jabhat al-Nusra or from any other?
Even with the pending plan between the EU and Turkey to shut down migration routes and vet refugees before admitting them to the EU, Narek says Europe has no idea who they're letting in. The conflicts moving along with migrant populations as they flee war and violence are certainly not limited to Belgium. With Turkey's recent offer to take back all migrants who cross its border into the EU, the already complicated dynamics there are sure to grow. The decades-long sectarian conflict between Kurds and Turks continues and has flared up recently. And the Kurd-Turk tension extends beyond the country's borders. In September of last year in central Stockholm, police came under attack during a clash between the two groups. And as the refugee crisis expands, more and more people are thrown together in refugee centers. Across the region, there have been numerous reports of attacks against Christian asylum seekers housed in these facilities. In a bid to address the ongoing attacks, several German states have segregated Christians and Muslims into separate detention centers. Lisa Poulsen Galal from Roskilde University in Denmark has studied anti-Islamic sentiments among Christian refugees from Iraq. She says that when the first influx of Iraqis came to Denmark in the 80s, there were never any issues between Muslims and Christians in the asylum centres, but that has changed.
The Christians I have talked to in Denmark, They talk about the threat from Islam and about the conflicts in the Middle East. They say it was good once. They lived like brothers and sisters. Now the threat is not just in the Middle East, but also in Europe, they say.
But Galal says it's not just the radical Islamists who incite the violence.
There's a risk for this becoming more frequent because they're coming from sectarian conflicts. The religious differences are used in the wars. We saw it here as well during the Balkan Wars, where Bosnian Muslims coming here then had conflicts with Serbs already here.
And there have been attacks in Denmark. Bagok has Kurdish background but has lived in Denmark his whole life. He was at a recent rally in a predominantly Muslim neighborhood in Copenhagen when violence broke out. The event was held in support of rebuilding efforts in the Kurdish town Kobane. Bagok says pro-Kurdish demonstrators came under attack.
They shouted that IS are not the terrorists, the Kurds are. They shouted Allahu Akbar several times.
When one of the attackers started shouting to the others to get knives, the pro-Kurdish demonstration decided to break up. Earlier that year, another pro-Kurdish demo in Copenhagen ended in violence when an IS supporter drove up to the demo and started shouting that the Kurds would be annihilated. As the influx of migrants continues, untempered by Balkan borders closures or EU-Turkey talks, these very real sectarian tensions will likely continue to spark across the region. Tom Carstensen, FSRN, Copenhagen.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Wisconsin billionaire, Koch brother ally, and Scott Walker political contributor John Menard is breaking labor law at Menards, a company with more than 300 facilities in 14 states. The National Labor Relations Board says it's contacted Menards demanding an end to the labor law violations. The board is seeking a national order forcing Menards to respect the law and its workers' rights. The labor law violations include threatening managers with 60% pay reductions if workers form unions at Menards and imposing mandatory employment arbitration agreements on Menards workers, which preclude employees from engaging in lawful, concerted activities to exercise their labor rights. OPEIU Local 153 attorney Seth Goldstein filed the numerous unfair labor practice charges against Menards.
The NLRB has reviewed our charges and investigated it, and they have found that the company has violated several sections of the National Labor Relations Act. The mandatory arbitration provisions are illegal, and they found that in each case, the agreement prevented employees from filing charges with the National Labor Relations Board. And in at least one case, they failed to provide the employees with the opportunity to file class actions in court, which, of course, is also violative of the National Labor Relations Act.
The NLRB says Menards is also breaking labor law when it comes to its merit evaluations policies by discriminatorily refusing to provide merit pay determinations to employees who engaged in protected, concerted, and/or union activities.
Probably have the people that have not gotten their merit raises because of their merit evaluations. And of course, you don't even know whether or not these employees were ever shown their merit evaluations. I mean, you can't really trust what the company's saying, but we're going to have to rely on employees coming forward. And then in our investigation, if we find a case of at least one of them where the company wasn't truthful, then, you know, we can then go back to the NLRB and force them to investigate all the merit evaluations.
Goldstein urges Menards workers to contact OPEIU Local 153 if they believe they've been hurt by Menards labor law violations. John Menard is extremely anti-union. He gave $1.5 million to Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's campaign in the recall election that Walker faced after Walker stripped public sector workers of their collective bargaining rights. WIN is made possible in part by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio, live nationwide weekdays noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jamie Haddad, Kanan Schlesinger, Les Hudson, and Jenna Yokoyama. The producer is Lisa Loving. Special thanks to Chris Andre. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. I'm Jamie Haddad.
And I'm Lisa Loving. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you tomorrow night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
So we're going to be meeting this evening at the first...
A coalition of activist groups tonight hold a special event on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Keystone XL pipeline, and climate change. I spoke earlier today with organizer David Delk from the Alliance for Democracy, Portland.
So we're going to be meeting this evening at the First Unitarian Church at 7 o'clock. Doors open at 6:30. Our presentation or a meeting is titled the TPP Keystone XL and Climate Change, How Bad Trade Deals Undermine the Environmental Movement. So we're focused on specifically how the Trans-Pacific Partnership will impact efforts to